Have you ever found yourself wondering why some people think the world is flat? Or that the royal family are a secret race of lizard people controlling the world? Have you ever wondered why so many people seem to think the deadly pandemic we are living through is a hoax? Well, if you have, this podcast series is here to help make sense of all the madness. Hello and welcome to Defining Conspiracism with me, your host Oz Katterjee, where we will be going on a journey with Jewish News UK to the heart of modern conspiracy theories and their proliferation across the world. Joining us on this episode are the BBC's specialist reporter for disinformation and social media, Mariana Spring, the Community Security Trust's Director of Policy, Dave Rich, writer and actor Marlon Solomon, and astrophysicist and astronomer royal for Scotland, Catherine Haymans. Hello, thanks for joining us, guys. To start things off, why don't we introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about how you came across the world of conspiracism at large, so to speak. Dave, why don't you go first?
Hi, Oz. I'm Dave Rich. I'm Director of Policy at the Community Security Trust, which is a Jewish charity that deals with anti-Semitism and Jewish security in the UK. And really, if you're researching anti-Semitism, if you're looking at who it is who poses a threat to Jewish people, you can't avoid conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories are absolutely the fuel that drives anti-Semitism, drives hatred of Jews, and has been really for centuries, but particularly for the last 200 years, it's absolutely core to it.
Marlon.
Hi, Oz. I am an actor, performer, and I do a show about conspiracy theories called Conspiracy Theory: A Lizard's Tale, which I've been doing since 2017, before everyone else was doing it. Yeah, and it's been running since then. There's a few shows left, but it's nearly coming to an end and it's time for another show. But I've, since doing this, I've become very interested in conspiracy theories and conspiracy culture and everything that goes around it.
Catherine, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Catherine Haymans. I'm a professor at the University of Edinburgh, and I'm also the Astronomer Royal for Scotland.
And Mariana?
I'm the BBC's specialist disinformation and social media reporter, which means I've spent the past 18 months in particular investigating the human cost of online conspiracy theories, from COVID to vaccines to elections, and now that's pivoting towards climate change. And speaking to the people whose lives have been impacted, whether because they've fallen for this stuff or because someone they care about has fallen for it.
For me as a journalist, I'm obviously quite interested in this field, but it's a new beat, isn't it? There hasn't been like a specialist disinformation sort of reporter correspondent before. It's a new type of role. Can you tell us a little bit about it? And, you know, you are one of the very first of your type of reporter. So, you know.
Yeah, definitely. It's a whole new role and team at the BBC that's existed since before the pandemic, that actually was established originally with a view to covering the US election. Before that, I'd covered a lot to do with Facebook groups and the UK election and general social media investigations. It's a beat that the US has been much further ahead of us on. They've had dedicated reporters working for New York Times, NBC, BuzzFeed, CNN, who've been covering this, particularly since the 2016 election in the States. But we've absolutely seen this huge boom in online conspiracies and disinformation. And as a consequence, it's become very much a beat in itself. And there's far too much work for even just one person. I work with a great team at the BBC of fact checkers, of analysts who work for BBC Monitoring, and of people who generally investigate all things sinister on the internet. And so I think that it's not just a new beat, but a growing one, and one that I'll be continuing to cover for quite some time.
Well, hopefully we can dive right into that in a moment. But Dave, I'm going to come to you first right now. On the last pod, I put the idea forward that anti-Semitism was like the oldest conspiracy theory. There was a bit of pushback there that it might not be the oldest, but you know, it is one of the oldest that still exists with us today as a conspiracy theory. So can you talk to me about how anti-Semitism and conspiracism are sort of, you know, connected in a way that they're really hard to disentangle sometimes?
If we're talking about Western societies and Western civilization. I don't know if it's the oldest, but it's definitely, it's kind of the uber conspiracy theory, and it tends to be the place that all the other conspiracy theories end up going to. It's always there in the mix. And the reason for this is because anti-Semitism, certainly in Christian or Christian-based civilizations, goes back to the original myth that Jews were responsible for the death of Christ, which was a part of early Christian teaching, not a mainstream part, but a part. And that's something we're always going to see, is these conspiracy theories kind of tag alongside mainstream teachings and ideas. In the Middle Ages, the idea that Jews kidnapped Christian children and drained their blood for religious purposes became known as the blood libel and led to massacres and expulsions all over Europe. Fast forward to the modern day, you have the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is this forgery or this hoax cooked up by the secret police in Tsarist Russia, claiming there was a global Jewish conspiracy to undermine governments and foment revolution and war and so on. And the thing that linked all of these were ideas that Jews had inordinate power, right? I mean, think how much power you need to kill the Son of God or to be kidnapping children and all the rest of it. The Jews worked together secretly in concert across international borders for some kind of nefarious Jewish purpose that worked against the common good of humanity. And of whatever was perceived to be the common good in any society at any given time, this supposed Jewish conspiracy was held up as the real reason why things aren't working. You know, so Jews were blamed for capitalism and for communism and for revolution and all sorts of different contradictory ideas. But it always came back to this idea of secret power, with Jews working behind the screen, the scenes, pulling the strings. And really from the middle of the 19th century, sort of early middle 19th century, up to and including the Second World War and afterwards in the mid 20th century, anti-Semitic conspiracy theories absolutely dominated conspiracist thinking and writing and politics in Europe. Everything traced back to it. And so you have a situation now where people who get into conspiracy theories nowadays, even if their entry point has nothing to do with Jews, the moment they start digging down and asking, well, why is this happening? Who is behind it? What's the history to all of this? One way or another, they always end up encountering anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about Jews, either now or previously in history, because this vast reservoir of material is just sitting there, and it's unavoidable for people who kind of move in that world. So I think that's why it just looms so large, even in conspiracist networks for whom that is not the primary focus and who certainly don't think of themselves as anti-Semites, but it's unavoidable.
Marlon, like some of our listeners, you came into this kind of world and you started learning about this stuff slightly later on in life, and you sort of, you know, you built a show based on your findings. So some of what Dave has said about how conspiracism, you know, entangles its way through anti-Semitism, and they, you know, they sort of feed off each other. Can you talk to me a little bit about your experience, you know, talk us through your journey and how you came across some of this stuff to begin with?
There's a few strands really why I got sucked into reading stuff about conspiracy culture and why people believe outlandish conspiracy theories. And the first strand is that I used to be one. In my early 20s, I've had about 6 months, I think, teetering just on the edge of the rabbit hole. And, you know, a friend quickly slapped me around the face and got me out of it. But yeah, I do have that.
So what sort of conspiracies had you, you know, confused at the time?
That's the really embarrassing bit. Yeah, I watched Loose Change, which was, you know, it was just after, it was post-student malaise. Loose Change is the most watched conspiracy film ever, or it was when I researched this a few years ago, which was made by a group of students themselves about 9/11 being an inside job. And this became hugely successful. And it was at the birth of the internet, kind of, well, when, the, you know, you're talking mid-noughties. And it really took off. I mean, I think it's been viewed millions upon millions of times. And this was doing the rounds when I was younger, and I got into it via that. And, you know, I do think, because I didn't go that deeply into it, but yeah, I did start, I had people showing me videos of really crazy stuff. And then later on, years later, I got involved in it because of what I'd been hearing in my local area. I lived in Chorlton, I worked behind a bar, and I was listening to the punters, David Icke fans, and I was stunned. I went home and watched some of his YouTube videos, and some of this stuff was regurgitated Nazi-era anti-Semitism. I'm Jewish myself. And so I started getting into David Icke. His show at the Apollo, which was in 2017, was attended by over 2,000 people. And in it, I was watching this on YouTube, he has this whole section called Rothschild Zionism. And it's that anti-Semitism that Dave is talking about, that medieval anti-Semitism that grew into the Protocols of Zion about secret Jewish control of the world, refracted through the prism of modern anti-Zionism. And the shocking thing was how he'd been getting away with this for decades in huge theatres in Britain. And seemingly to me, the anti-racist movement had done absolutely nothing about it. It was a big shock to me. It felt effectively like Jews had, you know, we'd been abandoned unless the anti-Semitism came with a swastika. So for me, it suddenly kind of mobilized me as a Jewish person. And I had an idea to make a show that explains anti-Semitism, because I didn't really know that much about anti-Semitism myself, and I had to learn about the Protocols of Zion. And I went on a journey myself, and I thought it would be quite useful to do a spoken word show. It's kind of documentary theatre. It's weird. I don't really know how you describe it, but it's basically a TED talk with songs. And so I just wanted to find a way of explaining the problem of anti-Semitism with a few laughs, making sure that, you know, the seriousness of the issue carries through. And so that's what I did. And I'm still doing it now. There was a bit of a demand for anti-Semitism was in the news a lot, which coincided with what I was doing.
So Mariana, you heard a bit about Marlon's experience there. Obviously this, you know, in your beat, this must be something you come across a lot. People, you know, must watch a video, be encouraged by their friends, by their peers, by social media to check this thing out, and then suddenly their worldview might start shifting, and they might lose in touch with what's real and what's not. What can you tell me about, you know, your experiences, what you've learned over the years? What role you think conspiracy theories are having on society right now?
You're totally right. The number of people I hear from, either who have loved ones, friends, relatives who've fallen deep into online conspiracies, particularly during the pandemic, or from people themselves who have got really into this stuff, is huge. And it's continued to increase over the past 18 months. And it's really sad often hearing about the impact that this has on people's relationships, on their lives, how I've interviewed various people who've come to direct harm because they chose not to have a vaccine, or because they didn't think COVID was real, because they became involved in these online communities or sucked into these belief systems. And I think it's very common that for a lot of people, it will just start as a video or a post or something they see online that taps into something deeper. Perhaps it's a very legitimate distrust they have for institutions or governments or leaders who they feel have let them down. Perhaps it's because of bad experiences they've had in their life at different points, combined with often the circumstances around that. The pandemic has obviously been a really stressful, frightening time for a lot of people, and people respond to that in different ways. I did a really interesting interview with a woman who used to be a very hardened anti-vaxxer, but it led her into all kinds of other extreme conspiracies, from flat earth to everything about 9/11, the whole shebang. And she lives in the Isle of Wight now, and she spoke to me about it back in sort of January of this year. And she explained to me how very much for her, it was growing up as a kid and then as a teenager and a young person, her family, her friends were very anti-establishment. And there was this deep distrust she very legitimately had in the establishment because of experiences that she'd had. But it then meant that when the internet appeared and she could go on YouTube and she signed up to Facebook, she was being exposed to stuff that tapped into that. And it took her years to get out of that, because it began with kind of questioning one specific conspiracy about vaccines being poisonous and specific claims. And then she began to think, oh, actually, is all of this untrue? And what about the people who are spreading this? What about the people who are promoting it? And it was then that she found herself sort of out the other side. And now she speaks very passionately about the damage that online conspiracies can do. And I think it's quite important when we talk about this to think about people in two categories. There are a very small minority of very committed activists and influencers who attempt to spread harmful falsehoods about everything from the pandemic, anti-Semitic conspiracies, stuff to do with elections, QAnon, which people may or may not have heard of, this unfounded conspiracy that Donald Trump is waging a secret war against satanic paedophiles. And those people are the people that are doing this often to gain otherwise. They want to increase their following. They want to grow their political influence. They want to make money out of this. They enjoy being powerful in this way. But then the larger group of people, and the people I spend a lot of time talking to, are the people who are a layer out from that, the people who fall victim to the falsehoods, lies, conspiracies that they are promoting, the people who are in effect exploited. And that can be the hardest sometimes, because these people genuinely believe this stuff and they have been misled, and trying to expose that. I mean, the most I can do is expose the people who are spreading this stuff and try and better understand how certain people have fallen for these kinds of conspiracies. But getting out of that mentality can be really difficult, particularly when you're surrounded by it day in, day out.
You're talking about these online communities. Something that I noticed back in April 2020 was some friends started sending me stuff that they were seeing on Instagram and Facebook, which was coming from the community of life coaches. Now, I'm not casting aspersions on all life coaches here, but I've got friends who are yoga teachers, one in particular. And she was saying that she was seeing people posting stuff with millions of followers, people who, you know, one of a huge number of people that promote very healthy living. And so eating everything plant-based, eating raw foods, and then, you know, rejecting any foreign bodies. But they hadn't been posting anything about conspiracy theories before. And suddenly there was people with a couple of million followers who have quite a lot of power posting stuff. I've got it on my phone here. Well, this person got about 2 million followers. And she just asked some questions about why Ofcom was banning everything to do with 5G. Have you read Brave New World? And the influence that has on people, and that it's completely unaccountable. Have you come across this in that world?
Absolutely. And one thing that I've found throughout the pandemic is that this online conspiracy movement is actually made up of people with completely different worldviews and political opinions on all sides of the spectrum, who often, as you say, have ready-made communities of millions of followers that they can reach. So we've seen how the alternative lifestyle and yoga community have often been a place where some of the people who are influential in that community go on to spread harmful falsehoods about vaccines or about COVID or about 5G. But we've also seen that happen on the far right. There are various far right groups that have co-opted conspiracy movements. So Tommy Robinson's Telegram channel, for instance, is really linked to a lot of the Telegram channels where we see these conspiracies spread. And I think it's a really interesting point you make, because there are some people who have built entire followings and communities solely on promoting conspiracies. But a lot of people who've turned their attention to this during the pandemic weren't interested in this before. They didn't used to spread this kind of thing. They weren't really into flat earth or 9/11. But the pandemic has been a catalyst for them becoming involved in this conspiracy movement. And you've seen that both from the point of view of the influencers and the people who are being affected by it, who the number of people who message me and say, oh, my mum, my dad, my cousin, my auntie, they never would have been into this before. I don't know what's happened. That's so common.
Catherine, Mariana just brought up flat earth, and that's why I was so desperate to have an astrophysicist on the show. You must have encountered this. If you haven't, I'm still, you know, really, really keen to know about your views on it. Also, you know, astrophysics is probably one of those things that, you're probably keen to get more people interested in astrophysics, and this is probably the worst possible vector for people to suddenly become interested in, you know, the universe and the things around us. So yeah, if you could tell us about your thoughts on flat Earth theory.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the vast majority of people in the world are, you know, there's an overwhelming body of evidence for our Earth being a sphere. You know, astronauts going up into space and looking down and taking photographs for us, and, you know, including Elon Musk and his SpaceX mission. You know, there's so many different pieces of evidence to show us that our Earth is a sphere. Yet there's a growing body of people who have gone back to this ancient old theory that the Earth is flat. And it's really hard, I think, for a lot of us to understand how people could believe that.
Can I play devil's advocate for one moment before throwing straight back to you? What if you believe that, you know, Elon Musk, NASA, that there's a global conspiracy to lie to you, that it's all done in, you know, film studios? So that's the question that would be thrown back to you, right?
Do you know what? I'd be happy with that. I'm quite happy with people who say, I only believe things if I see it with my own two eyes. That's absolutely fair enough. And a lot of people who like the idea of the flat Earth, you know, that all the questions that they ask that motivate their need to have a flat Earth can be answered with a single word, which is gravity. So, for example, you know, people say, well, if the Earth is a sphere and you're standing on the bottom of it, why don't you fall off? And you're like, well, that's not the way gravity works. Gravity pulls you to the center of the Earth, and so you're not going to fall off. And then they say, I don't believe in gravity. And do you know what? I'm all right with that as well, because, you know, scientists, our job is to disprove theories. We can never, ever prove a theory. So I'm okay with people saying, I don't believe this. You know, that's okay. That's part of our job as scientists is to question lots of different theories. But I think the biggest problem for me with flat Earth is some really basic observations you can make from your back garden shows you with just a little bit of logic that the Earth has to be a globe. So, for example, the moon, right? Everyone's seen the moon. You know, everyone knows and loves what the moon looks like. No matter where you are on Earth, the moon looks exactly the same. But if you were on a flat Earth and the moon was above you, if you were looking at it from one side, you'd see something different than if you were looking at it at the other side. That's just really basic logic. And then a lunar eclipse is when the Earth comes between the sun and the moon. And I hope these people have seen the lunar eclipse, because it's gorgeous. They happen quite often. And you always see the shadow of the Earth is a circle. And again, you just can't have that working with a flat Earth. And I mean, you do try to talk to these people. You know, they genuinely believe this. And they, when you talk about things like a lunar eclipse, they're all, you know, don't worry about that. And I think the problem is not with trying to explain science. I think there's this deep distrust of science and scientists, and that's a real big problem. You know, if the pandemic has shown us anything, it's that science is really, really important. And the fact that there is this growing distrust of, and the fact that there's this belief that this giant conspiracy, you know, it's not just astronomers, geophysicists, any sort of scientist, there's so many air pilots, you know, anyone who charters a boat, you know, it all requires the Earth to be spherical. There'd have to be such a giant conspiracy. And the fact that there's this belief that so much of the world is in on this secret is, that's the problem for me. Not that people don't believe in the science. I'm quite happy with people saying I don't believe with gravity, but just, yeah, the world around them and this distrust of everyone is what's really worrying and concerning.
Mariana, I'm actually going to throw back to you here, because I want to understand how something that can seem so balmy, so harmless, can actually manifest itself in real world harm, you know, and people can go from sharing a jokey thing on Facebook to ending up nearly punching Chris Whitty in the face on the streets of London.
I think that's one of the most concerning things, really, is a lot of this stuff does seem really bonkers and bizarre and if I had a penny for how many times people ask me, who believes this stuff? How could you believe this stuff? I would be much richer than I currently am. But I think absolutely during the pandemic, we've come to realize the human cost of this online disinformation and the real world impact it can have. Everything from people who, there was a man called Brian, for example, who I interviewed. He lived in Florida with his wife, Erin. They'd both been scrolling on Facebook. They saw that COVID was linked to 5G technology, that it wasn't real, it was a hoax, or that it just wasn't that serious. And neither of them followed health guidance. Neither of them called for help when they fell ill. And they subsequently ended up in the hospital in Florida, very, very poorly on ventilators. Brian luckily survived, but his wife, Erin, later died from complications linked to having COVID. They both had coronavirus. And speaking to him and hearing how much he regretted believing what he'd seen on Facebook, I mean, I even interviewed Facebook about this and I said to them, what do you say to Brian? Because he saw this on your platform and it was I probably don't even need to say what the response was, but needless to say, it wasn't particularly satisfying. And it's not just that. I mean, I had this wonderful woman in her 80s who got in touch with me about how an anti-vax video that was sent to her via WhatsApp scared her off having the jab. And her husband, both in their 80s and vulnerable to COVID, were not going to get the jab because it had freaked them out so much. And I investigated that video and it promoted a number of false claims. It featured people who were brandishing expertise before going on to say stuff that was just demonstrably untrue. And that has really severe consequences for people's lives. And it's not just these individual stories of harm and relationship breakdowns as well. I interviewed the son of Kate Shemarani, who people may or may not have heard of. She is a conspiracy influencer who has been struck off by nursing bodies. She used to be a practicing nurse, and her son spoke very powerfully of the personal impact of all this stuff and how he felt they could no longer have a relationship anymore and how devastated he was at that. But bigger picture, there's also been violence inspired by this stuff. What happened at Capitol Hill in the US, conspiracy theories like QAnon made the ground fertile for people to become effectively radicalized and to behave as they did and to commit these acts of violence. And a number of those who were there were linked to QAnon and other extreme groups that have sprung up on social media but have become radicalized by conspiracies. Here in the UK, we're seeing a real increase in violent rhetoric used by conspiracy movements. The suggestion that politicians, journalists, including myself, doctors, nurses should be hanged or even executed, making anti-Semitic comparisons to what happened during the Holocaust and genocide. Really, really offensive stuff, but also that is really frightening. I'm speaking to doctors who are so worried about the real world implications of this that someone could legitimately hurt them because they believe they're complicit in these totally unfounded, nefarious plots. And I think that's where this stuff becomes less funny and much more harrowing.
Catherine, you had a question you wanted to ask.
Yeah, so I think, you know, what Mariana's saying there is really important. You know, the flat earth stuff, you know, we've known for more than 2,000 years that the earth is not flat. You know, it goes back to the Greek and the Egyptians doing really basic measurements. Yet somehow this theory has reemerged in just the last decade, and that's the power of the internet and social media. And you know, the flat earth has no real world implications. You know, it doesn't matter if people believe that the earth is flat. There's a community that's been formed there that, you know, and it's important that people have their community and that they feel that they belong. And it doesn't have a bad impact. Yet it sort of heralded the, just, you can see how much power social media has, and now how that's gone on to something that actually really is damaging the anti-vax movement and the misinformation about COVID and the power of the internet that it has, and how as a culture we have to now learn how to distinguish between what is truth and what isn't.
So that is a really interesting point there.
Catherine, I think the way that I understand flat earth, the way it kind of makes sense to me in inverted commas, is that it's an extension of quite a lot of other conspiracy theories, or just an offshoot of the super galactic conspiracy. So the conspiracy the overarching conspiracy theory that David Icke believes in, and he's Britain's leading conspiracy theorist, is that we're in a holographic simulation, just like the Matrix, and it's these evil aliens called the Archons who have been sucking the goodness out of humanity for 2,000 years. So therefore, that nothing is real. And if you believe that, and a lot of people do, then flat Earth is just part of the simulation, and it's just an offshoot of that. And it just seems to be that, well, it is the most wacky. But if you think that Britain's leading conspiracy theorist, who speaks to Trafalgar Square in front of tens of thousands of people and sells out arenas that are big enough for quite big rock bands, believes that reptilian-like shapeshifters secretly control our world and that we're living in a simulation, then yeah, you can believe, it kind of makes sense why people believe flat Earth, I think.
So I just wanted to come in there because the on the last episode, David Baddiel brought up the fact that when he had started investigating flat Earth theory, that he himself had reached a point where he found a conspiracy that Jews were somehow responsible for the idea that the world is a sphere, right? You know, he's like somehow it always ends up back with the Jews. So, Dave, I wanted to come to you there. Also, I was hoping you could bring us some historical context, you know, especially considering what happened on Capitol Hill on January the 6th. You know, we do have historical comparisons that might not be the strongest, you know, because of other events and other things, but political leaders using lies to whip up their supporters into a violent rage is not uncommon historically, should we say?
I mean, this issue of what you might call real-world harms of conspiracy theories is something that has been absolutely central to the history of anti-Semitism. So in the 14th century, when there was the Black Death in Europe, Jews were blamed in large parts of Central Europe for poisoning the wells, and this was causing the plague. And this resulted in Jews being expelled from huge swathes of Western and Central Europe and migrating eastwards. The reason why there was an enormous Jewish population in Poland at the time of the Second World War can be dated back to this massive migration. Of course, that population in Poland, 3 million Jews, were wiped out by the Nazis, who believed they were fighting their mortal foe because there was a vast global Jewish conspiracy to destroy the Aryan race and all the rest of it. And this is why, you know, the historian Norman Cohn, when he wrote his history of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, he called the book a warrant for genocide, because anti-Semitism has always been used by dictators and other leaders to whip up the mob against a scapegoat, against another target. And it's almost as if Jews are the ultimate victims, but they're not really the point of a lot of anti-Semitism. A lot of anti-Semitism, there is another audience that anti-Semitism is there for. And that is why you get rampant anti-Semitism and widespread belief in the idea of a Jewish conspiracy in countries where there are no Jews. So I mentioned Poland. In Poland in 1968, the communist government launched an anti-Zionist campaign, as they put it, which was literally just anti-Semitism repackaged. And thousands of Jews lost their jobs, lost their homes, left the country. And this was within 25 years of the Holocaust. There were barely any Jews left in Poland. But they were held up as the scapegoat, as the target, as the enemy for the government there, even though there were hardly any Jews. And we see this repeatedly. And you fast forward to the modern day, you know, a lot of the far right nowadays believes in a conspiracy theory called the Great Replacement, which is the idea that mass immigration, non-white immigration into Western societies is designed to bring about a genocide of the white race in their thinking. And of course, who is it that's organizing this mass immigration? It's the Jews. It's people like George Soros or the Rothschilds or whoever. So this is why a neo-Nazi called Robert Bowers went into a synagogue in Pittsburgh and murdered 11 Jewish people at prayer one Sabbath morning, because that synagogue worked with a local refugee society, right? But he saw this as the local representation of this vast global conspiracy to bring about a genocide of the white race. He saw this as a defensive action, actually. And so this this is kind of the sharpest end, if you like, of how conspiracy theories can drive not just self-harm in the form of people who won't take vaccines, although of course that also has secondary harms to others, but it can drive everything up to genocide. And it gets used unscrupulously, and it almost becomes immaterial whether the people using it for these political purposes actually believe in it or not.
On the point of that you just finished on there, Dave, I wanted to bring Mariana back in here, because actually, you know, you deal with conspiracy theories, that's one thing, but you also deal with disinformation. And, you know, especially as we've seen in recent years, not that this is a new phenomenon, but I'm just talking about its contemporary use on the battlefield in Syria, when it comes to the Skripal poisonings, the downing of a Malaysian Airlines flight. Russia, China, Iran, countries like this have been operating, you know, they spend vast amounts of money in creating disinformation about, you know, real world global events, often to absolve them of any guilt for human rights abuses, atrocities of any kind. So, you know, how do you view disinformation and conspiracy theories? How are they different? How are they distinct? And, you know, what's the kind of, what's the purpose in disinformation from your perspective?
I think it's really interesting breaking down the terms, really, and also how a lot of those terms have become very politicized as well when we talk about this. So the term disinformation, for example, that is the kind of more specific version, I guess, of misinformation, which broadly is misleading information shared wherever, but most commonly on social media these days, disinformation being the deliberate sharing of misleading information. But that term disinformation, for example, recently China have been very critical of the BBC's coverage of Uyghur people and their treatment of Uyghur people, and have said that we are conducting a disinformation campaign. And so you see how, in the same way that fake news was used as well in that sense, it became a weapon for different political figures to attack others that they do not like. Absolutely, it's used in that sense. I think the best way of breaking it down often is to try and distinguish between state-sponsored disinformation and disinformation campaigns. We often talk about foreign influence operations, and following the 2016 elections, that was a really big topic of conversation. It's still a really important area, and influence operations are increasingly sophisticated, but I think this landscape has become much more muddled. And so actually a lot of disinformation we see is also homegrown. It's by someone sitting in their bedroom in Burnley as much as it is someone sitting in a basement in St. Petersburg. And these people all fit into the same ecosystem. They fuel it, they engage with it, but they might have very, very different intentions. State-sponsored disinformation, for example, we've seen some examples of anti-vax influence operations that seek to sow seeds of discord to make people doubt specific vaccines or not want to have them. But we've also seen anti-vax activists who want to grow big followings, who are speaking on stage at rallies, who want to increase their political influence, spreading these same falsehoods. And in some ways they're helping one another, but actually they have different intentions. I think the difference between disinformation and conspiracies is quite complex, and I often kind of think about how they vary. I think disinformation, you're right, often feels much more deliberate, and it's also much easier to debunk, to say this is incorrect and here's why. Conspiracy theories are much harder to debunk in that way, because often they are these far-fetched claims about nefarious global agendas that to the average person just seem totally wild, but are pretty hard to demonstrably disprove. And that means that they are also super, the kinds of things that spread very, very easily on social media. And so I think that when we talk about this and think about this, we have to think about all of the bad actors who might have, it isn't just conspiracy influencers on social media. There are politicians that promote disinformation online. There are celebrities. There are all kinds of different people, but they all are a part of this ecosystem. And unfortunately, an increasingly large and committed online conspiracy movement has formed as a consequence of various parts of this disinformation ecosystem.
So being a reporter that's covered the Middle East extensively, particularly Syria, I know the Russian government has deployed disinformation campaigns, quite sophisticated ones that have involved hack and leak, hack and dump information, you know, using distorting information, using kernels of truth. And the point of it has always been not to get people to join in and deny war crimes and defend the Assad regime as the Russian government wants people to do, but just to sufficiently muddy the waters so that people who don't know enough look at a situation with competing information and say, I don't even know what's going on here. I guess we'll never know, you know, and that sort of just be overwhelming people with information is enough to create a political deadlock, to create a situation in which, you know, the disinformation has had the desired effect. You know, people can't form policy to combat the Uyghur genocide. People can't form policy to defend Syrian people from chemical weapons attacks if they can't even agree on the basic facts in the diplomatic international sphere. So in disinformation and conspiracy theories, when weaponized, actually do have a very important and you know, damning effect, because essentially the way I understand society today, contemporary society and liberal democracies, is a lot of it's based on faith. A lot of it's based on faith and access to good information. And you find yourself, if you can disrupt that very, very easily. You can disrupt liberal democracy at its very core, at its very foundation, by you know, if people no longer have faith in the information they're being presented with, they can no longer make informed choices. Suddenly you're a step closer to tyranny. You know, that's sort of the idea. And, you know, it may seem alarmist to say like that, but there are real world examples of harm, of violence being carried out by people who have been swayed by disinformation. One of the things that I've come across, especially with Syria, now, you know, this is what has infuriated the Russian government in recent years, has been Bellingcat, who are citizen journalists who use open source information. Open source, for people that don't know, not familiar with the term, say you're walking down the road to the shop and you see a car accident, and then you pick up your phone and you film that accident, and then you post that to Twitter. That video that you've posted to Twitter, that is a piece of open source information, whether it comes from security cameras or you know, Instagram accounts or whatever. All of that, satellite feeds, can build a comprehensive picture of what happened when looking at it from a macro perspective. You bring all the sources together, and then you can build a picture of what really happened using open source information to confirm or deny your theories. That essentially is a very, very new journalistic approach to the scientific method, Catherine. I feel like science plays a really, really important role in defeating misinformation. Not necessarily disinformation, because sometimes you can reach a certain point where if you believe that everyone's lying to you, then it's hard to believe anything. Why should you believe any sort of science? But there is something about a rigorous, you know, peer-reviewed, repeatable scientific method that is so important. And I'd like you to give us hope for why we should keep fighting, Catherine.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah, training people in the scientific method is really important. So what is the scientific method? So you come up, we have a hypothesis, what you think is going to happen. So our hypothesis could be that the Earth is flat. And then you design an experiment to go and test that hypothesis, and you assemble lots of data. So in your example, it was sort of lots of different recordings of an event. Or, you know, you could go on a boat around the Earth, which they did in sort of 16, whatever it was, to demonstrate that the Earth was spherical. Or you could cross the Antarctic. So there's another flat Earth one. You know, in the flat Earth scenario, the Antarctic is an ice wall that is a rim all the way around the edge of the flat Earth, because nobody's crossed the Antarctic apart from the fact that they have. So that scientific method is you design an experiment to address your hypothesis, and then you disprove it, which we would in the case of the flat Earth, or you find evidence to support it, but you can never actually prove your hypothesis. And I think, you know, sort of going back to the pandemic, there's been a real difference between governments which have been led by people who are originally trained as scientists. So for example, Angela Merkel, who's a chemist, and you can really see that in Germany's response to the pandemic. She's taken a really scientific approach to it, and other governments have eventually come to this line. But there is something very different about thinking about things scientifically. It's not this is my belief and I'm going to follow it. It's I think this might be the case. Let's try and get the evidence to support if this is a good idea or not. And the more we can train people in that sort of way of thinking, the better it is. And it also comes back to, how do we decide if something that we see on social media is trustworthy or not? Again, you know, the scientific method comes in there. Do I believe the person who's telling me this? Are they trained in this, in what they're talking about, or are they just spouting complete imaginary, or their belief? Is this their belief, or have they actually done an experiment, collected the data from lots of different sources to show that what they're saying is the truth?
So Marlon, you know, you came to a conclusion in your show. Now, it might not be the sort of conclusion that makes everyone feel very comfortable, but is there sort of a light at the end of the tunnel here? Is there something you can bring to us to give us a new or a fresh perspective on conspiracism as a whole, and how it, you know, works within our society?
Well, I finished the show with science, really, with good news, because what I found from researching conspiracy belief is that it's just the most pessimistic view that you can possibly have of the world, because everything has a sinister, evil explanation. The baddies aren't just bad, they're exponentially evil. And I found it genuinely really depressing looking into it. Because, I mean, there is things like narcissism involved in some of this, but I found that, and it was what I think when I had a little dalliance with conspiracy theories when I was a much younger man, it was science that pulled me out of it. It was people, you know, look at what the human beings actually do and have been doing. And I think I made the show in 2016, 2017, and at the end, I go through a list of what we'd achieved as a species in that year, which I think, yes, was 2016. Things like the first solar-powered plane had flown around the world. We'd found a vaccine for Ebola. More people now read and write. I think it was over 90% of people now read and write, which is the highest ever human literacy. I mean, there's tons of stuff like that. It's science and good news, which will hopefully pull some people who aren't too deep into the rabbit hole out, I find.
Mariana, I'd quite like, you know, obviously you've been at the front line of a lot of this stuff. I've seen, you know, some horrific abuse thrown your way from people who, you know, essentially you're trying to protect, you know, and you're getting attacked by people who think you are, you know, part of the conspiracy that's oppressing them. What are your thoughts on it? And you know, again, it must be an incredibly difficult position to be in. So how do you, what keeps you going?
Yeah, it's not very fun being on the receiving end of a lot of the abuse I get, and particularly because it's become much more violent over the past few months. Far more threats of violence, rape threats, really awful stuff. And I'm actually working on an investigation about online hate at the moment, looking into my own experience, which in some ways is quite a good way, I feel, of kind of dealing with it and channeling that energy into something positive and constructive. But I think for me, the thing that drives me, and that why I keep doing this job, is because I think it's really important and I love doing it. And I love speaking to the different people who've been impacted and feeling as though I can help them with my reporting, and that my reporting makes a difference to that. And for every 10 death threats I get, every Sebastian or Rosemary or Brian who I mentioned, whose story I can report on and that I think makes a real impact, is just so worth it. And actually, a lot of my reporting is inspired by the people who get in touch with me. So all of those horrible messages are, again, worth it, because it means that I get to have this rapport with the audience, which I think is something that's kind of increasingly important for the BBC in general, but allows you to really feel like, you know, to understand how this is affecting people and why. And people often ask me kind of what's like the main thing that you've learned this year. And perversely, I think it's actually that most people are good. And even when you talk to people who are at these rallies and have been really sucked in by these online conspiracies, you can have a really normal conversation. And then you'll say to them, why are you holding this banner about Bill Gates microchipping everyone? And they'll say to me, oh, because it's the genocide and this is happening and that is happening. And I'll explain to them why, you know, that's really offensive and also untrue and how there's no evidence to support it. And they'll often say to me, well, you think everyone is good, I think everyone is bad. And I think it runs very deep for some. And I'll never be able to remedy that, I guess. But I hope by covering it in some ways, I can help.
Dave, I'm going to throw to you for some final thoughts on, you know, are we all screwed? Is there light at the end of the tunnel? Can we, you know, mount a defense of truth, you know, and logic in the world?
Oh, look, I'm an optimist. So no, of course we're not all screwed. That's and most people in the world are good. But there's a couple of things, I think. One of them is, and just listening to Catherine and Mariana in particular and the kind of things they're talking about, conspiracy theorists present themselves as uncovering a small elite that is behind all the problems in the world. And yet the moment you actually start to unpack their claims, if their claims are true, the conspiracies they're talking about must involve vast numbers of people who are in on it, right? Whether it's, you know, all the astronauts and geophysicists and whatever who say for centuries have said the world is round, everyone working on vaccines and on COVID treatments and stuff. And so actually, of course, it's the conspiracy theorists who themselves view themselves as an elite with who've got the hidden knowledge, right? And then they're projecting that onto others. But in terms of what the future holds, I do think the experience we've been through in the last couple of years is going to leave a problematic legacy. You know, we at CST, we spent a few years investigating a small group of conspiracy theorists who would meet in London once a month called the Keep Talking Group. And we started getting interested in them because there'd be Holocaust deniers and neo-Nazis there. And we worked with the anti-fascist group Hope Not Hate to you know, get into their meetings and see what was going on. And they'd have monthly speakers on a whole range of conspiracy topics. So some of them would be very anti-Semitic and others would be about Big Pharma. And then once the Syrian civil war began, it was all the kind of Russian Assadist conspiracy theories about Duma and so on. But you have other stuff about 9/11 and Paul McCartney is still alive and all these kind of really cranky things, right? But you're basically talking about 30 or 40 people meeting in a pub once a month, right? Fast forward to now, you've got basically the same people speaking in front of thousands or tens of thousands of people in Trafalgar Square and loads of people who've never had any interaction with this world before getting sucked in and drawn in. And I've been really struck that the size of the protests after the lockdown has ended have basically held up, right? And this is now a movement just looking for a cause. It's a conspiracist movement. It doesn't trust anything the establishment does. And we've never really had anything like that in Britain, like a gilets jaunes type movement that is not far left or far right or any kind of fixed ideology, but just everything's a conspiracy and where are we going to land next? And I do worry that this movement is kind of here to stay. And whatever the next issue that comes along to challenge the country as a whole, they're going to be there. And it's going to be a very problematic part of the political landscape.
I think that's totally right. And it's really struck me as well how this anti-lockdown movement that has become muddled with very extreme online conspiracies has not gone away. In fact, it's become more violent and more committed in many ways. And I've been reporting on it for the past 18 months and seen how some people are so now attached to this conspiracy mentality that they're just waiting for the next thing. I did a report for Newsnight recently and it looked at the different directions that some of those protesters might take. There's definitely far right and extremist groups that are co-opting these movements and looking to recruit members through them. I'm also looking at climate change disinformation, and we're seeing a really big overlap in people who think that COVID is a hoax to limit our freedoms, and then that climate change is a hoax to limit our freedoms. And like Dave's pointed out numerous times, these same people they accuse of being part of this climate change cover-up, whether it's Soros or the Rothschilds, or, you know, it's the same anti-Semitic tropes that come up again and again and again. And we've seen it happen with QAnon, how QAnon is this kind of pervasive, all-inclusive conspiracy belief system, which attaches itself to the new thing. But this is very new to the UK. And I think that its real world consequences will continue to be felt in communities where you might not have ever expected this stuff to happen. And that will keep me busy for the next few months and years, no doubt.
We'll definitely be sure to keep following your reporting. So, Catherine, you have got our final thoughts. give us, you know, a reason to be hopeful. You're the only scientist among us here, so you're the only one that can actually slay these demons in front of us in ways that we can only report on, as it were. So give us hope that that things are can progress.
One thing that really gives me hope is how tech savvy the generation that's coming up is. Like, that my parents' generation believe everything that they see on a video because they have grown up with, you know, the BBC. They've watched the BBC. The BBC is the truth. And so now anything they see on the internet is the truth because they're used to that. Whereas my kids, they're not that, they know. They know when they see something on YouTube, whether it's solid or whether it's not coming from such a solid background. And that gives me real confidence that, you know, the generation that's coming up, you know, they've grown up with the internet and they know, they've got their own minds and they know what they discuss. They know that they've got their own bubbles and they know where they're going. So that gives me hope. The other thing is that, as Mariana was saying, you know, a lot of people are really very good, and science, when all around Brexit, all that time leading up to Brexit, it was always like, we don't want to listen to experts. But what I've seen in the change in the pandemic is suddenly that science and experts are important. And the scientists' voice in the media is coming back, and we are being trusted again by the majority of people. And we've just got to have that dialogue with people. Like, we've got to have the dialogue. We've got to talk to people, not make things complicated. And scientists are getting better at that. So that gives me hope that in the future we'll get there. But there's some work to be done in between now and this next generation coming up.
Thank you all for tuning in to Defining Conspiracism with Jewish News UK. I've been your host, Oz Katterjee, and I'd like to thank all our panel guests for their contributions, and hope to see you all on the next show.